All right, thanks. So for those of you who are here for CAPR and NRDA, this is, I doubt I'm going to have anything new to say to you. So the whole goal of this talk was really intended to be outreach from these programs to the rest of the Perimeter Institute. What I wanted to sort of highlight a little bit is what is going on here. Today is our Bridge Day. And these two workshops we have going on here, the CAPR workshop, this has its origins. CAPR is, in fact, named after Frank CAPR, the director. And it has in its origins a meeting that was held by some of us about 12 years ago, Patrick Brady really put together, at Frank CAPR's ranch in rural San Diego County. This was shortly after some seminal papers in this field were published. And it was essentially a bunch of, well, I was just freshly minted PhD, so it was me sort of sitting there going, ooh, look at what the big people are doing. But it was mostly smart people sitting around saying, what can we do with all this stuff now? And it's been a lot of fun to see the development over the past 12 years. The real goal of these CAPR workshops is to try to understand various issues and understanding the problems of motion of bodies around black holes, in particular including the impact of self-interaction. You can look up the motion around black holes without self-interaction in any GR textbook. But including the self-interaction is a hairy issue, and it's one that I'm going to outline. This talk has real important observational astrophysical consequences. The second workshop, NRDA, is Numerical Relativity and Data Analysis. It is a workshop that is connecting particularly spectacular recent breakthroughs in numerical relativity to the ongoing and future efforts to analyze data from gravitational wave interferometers, which I will also describe in this talk. The unifying theme, I would say, of both of these workshops, if I sort of take a broader perspective, is what we're trying to do here is to build a connection between solving the two-body problem in general relativity to issues in gravitational wave measurement, gravitational wave emission and measurement, and exploiting it so that we can learn as much astrophysical, what we can learn about the astrophysics of the sources that generate these things. Now, when I talk to astronomers, I like to point out to them that what makes this difficult is Einstein. Okay, if gravity had ended with Newton, the way I would describe the two-body problem is as follows. I would say, okay, give me two masses, M1 and M2, I'm going to reparameterize them slightly. I'm going to then choose an energy in an angular momentum. I will make a couple of definitions. Then, voila, the two-body problem completely solved in one slide. Okay, that is it. There's a little bit more you can do with this. You can do a lot of, in fact, you do a lot of important perturbations on top of this, and a lot of astrophysical phenomenology comes from that. But the fundamental theory of two-body problem Newtonian gravity begins and ends with what I have here. Not quite so simple when Einstein comes into the picture. So how do we solve the two-body problem in Einstein's general relativity? Well, what we teach our students in a GR class is essentially to do it in two steps. First, you build the space-time of some kind of a gravitating object. So illustrating schematically here, the idea that as your object gets more compressed, more massive and dense, the curvature is larger in some sense. And then you assert that freely falling objects respond to the space-time by following geodesics, trajectories that extremize the proper time as measured along that object. Okay, that is, if you take sort of a first-year graduate student's GR class, this is the fable that we tell our students. Step two of this process actually isn't so bad. Okay, as long as you've got your space-time in hand, learning to compute the geodesics is one of the first things we learn to do in an elementary GR class. You learn right away that one of the things you do is you reproduce Newton's gravity. What this is showing here are the orbits, or a particular moment in the orbits of the Galilean satellites around Jupiter. Beautiful test of Kepler's laws and perfectly reproduced in general relativity. And it introduces some new features, all of which have passed various tests to date. Showing here, just schematically illustrating the bending of light. So this is step two of my two-step process. Step one is not so simple. Okay, except for some fairly special cases, which we do teach everyone in our GR classes, building that space-time, the thing in which we compute those geodesics, is not such a simple exercise. If, again, when we had Newtonian gravity, our field equation was essentially, well, not just essentially, it was Poisson's equation. What's sort of nice about that is there's a linear relationship between your potential and the density, the left-hand side and the right-hand side, which makes it pretty easy to set boundary conditions and to understand how your field varies as your source varies. Go over to general relativity and it gets a lot nastier. Okay? Instead of having a linear relationship between field and source, you have a nonlinear differential operator that acts on your potential, the metric. And what acts as your source now is not just matter density, but it is all forms of energy. Okay, include your matter density, but also things like the flow of energy and momentum now become gravitating. That's something which I'm going to highlight the consequences of that for the purposes of these workshops later in this talk. When we go through this exercise, we find, first of all, as we would expect from special relativity intuition, that energy and mass have an equivalence to one another, all forms of energy gravitate. We also find that nothing can travel faster than light, including information about gravity, which tells us that this general relativity requires a notion of radiation. I'm going to return to radiation and what we're planning to do with that a little bit later. Before I move on, I want to go through a little bit more of some of the lore here to illustrate a lot of the foundational issues in our Capra workshop. So, if you ask what gravity is, Newton's versus Einstein's gravity, you have very different conceptions of what the nature of gravity, how you explain what gravity means is different in the two. So in Newtonian gravity, gravity is just a force. Okay, it's just like an electric force in which you have charges that respond to fields. In this case, the charge which sets the response is also the inertial mass, which ends up having important consequences later. But what this ends up meaning is that two objects that feel the same gravitational field in Newtonian gravity will respond in the same way, since they have their charges and their inertial masses are the same. And there's a great little video you can find online which illustrates what I think is probably one of the most important scientific results of our manned visits to the moon. This is an experiment that was done on the Apollo mission, illustrating that if you drop a hammer and a feather on the moon, they hit the ground at the same time. Those of you from the US, here are your tax dollars at work. Consequence of this tells us, Einstein reformulated this to say, you know what, if everything feels the same acceleration, why bother thinking of it as a force? Okay, let's throw that away. Why don't we just say that the hammer and the feather are just doing what space-time requires them to do? They are moving through the trajectory that the underlying space-time requires. And if you do that, you discover that the more interesting notion of acceleration is an acceleration that is defined relative to that free fall. Now, as people were beginning to come to grips with the problem of solving interesting questions of motions in general relativity, this led to a very interesting paradox. If you have an electron, and you're sitting in a, let's say, you know, we evacuate the atmosphere, I'm just holding an electron here, and I drop it near the surface of the Earth, will it radiate? There's two obvious viewpoints. The first one is, of course it radiates. This is going to be a completely non-relativistic limit. We know perfectly well that dipole radiation describes will describe the fields in that limit. Whatever happens as this electron falls towards the surface of the Earth, it's got to reproduce the dipole formula. Another completely obvious viewpoint is to say, of course, it doesn't. Okay, the charge is unaccelerated in the only meaningful sense. What if you want to frame everything in a completely covariant way, what is the acceleration that you put into that dipole formula? Okay, there's no way to, you know, there was no obvious way at least to define what it was meant by the acceleration of this thing that goes into that. So as far as GR is concerned, the charge is unaccelerated, there can't be any radiation. The first serious technique that was applied to solve this problem was undertaken in 1957 by John Wheeler. He held a vote at a conference much like this one and found that whether it was, of course it does or of course it doesn't, it was split 50-50. Now, in the intervening 53 years, both our results and our methods have improved somewhat. And we now know that it does, in fact, radiate. But what's kind of fascinating is that there's validity to this viewpoint. Okay, the reason that the GR intuition breaks down is that the electron is actually a non-local object. The electron itself is a point, but it's got field lines that extend over a very broad region. And what ends up causing this thing to accelerate, to generate radiation, is the fact that as it's falling, these non-local field lines are extending beyond the freely falling frame that we would normally and naively think about defining this thing. And beautiful calculations done in the 1960s showed that when you correctly take that into account, you precisely duplicate the dipole formula and you reproduce the naive intuition one would have. Now, this whole story becomes even more complicated when we are not talking about test bodies, which is what I've confined myself to so far. If you do not have a small body in somewhere, you do not have a simple space-time that you can simply expand around, the only thing that you can do that you are guaranteed is going to properly describe the motion of the system will be to directly solve the Einstein field equations. Take this nonlinear mess, solve it subject to your constraint of the Bianchi identities, crank it through, and extract your notion of motion from, infer it, so to speak, from the dynamics of the space-time that emerges. And that is what a lot of what we've been talking about for the last couple of days, fundamentally this comes from, and where the ensuing workshop starting tomorrow will carry it on. Now, what I want to switch to briefly before I go into some of these things is one of the consequences, let me go back to here, one of the consequences of constructing this solution is, of course, that you discover radiation in these in your spacetimes. To understand radiation, it's useful just to linearize everything. So take the nonlinear mess and linearize it around flat spacetime. You can see right away that your fully nonlinear field equation, at least in a certain gauge, just become a wave equation, where this box is your usual flat spacetime wave operator. Those of you who are concerned that in doing this, I'm throwing away the baby with the bathwater, since GR's nonlinearity is one of the most important consequences of one of the most important features of the theory, should note that thanks to work by Roger Penrose from years ago, we do have a fully nonlinear description of this. So I'm just losing this linearized variant essentially for intuition. So it's beautiful that we have this radiation that essentially enforces causality in our theory. What I would like to talk about to lead us to the measurement portion of this talk is the character of the radiation that comes out of this. So what we find when one solves that wave equation is that the leading radiation comes from variations in the mass quadrupole moment of your source. So it's similar to, just as in electrodynamics, the leading radiation comes from variations of a charged dipole moment. Gravity, being a spin 2 theory, suppresses the dipole radiation, and one sees that the leading radiation comes from variations of the mass quadrupole moment. What I want to highlight here, if you take this form, if you imagine you have some source that has some typical, has some size associated with it, and you ask to order of magnitude, what is the scale of the radiation that comes out of this thing, what you find is that the perturbation of your spacetime that we characterize as radiation has a form that looks as follows. There's this prefactor I'll discuss in a moment, and a 1 over r dependence, and then it's proportional to the amount of mass that's involved in your oscillating quadrupole, and the typical scale of velocities involved in the oscillating quadrupole squared. The thing which is a little bit frightening about this scale here is its prefactor. We are taking these numbers and we're multiplying it by g, a small number, divided by c, which is a big number, to the 4th power, making it an even bigger number. If you want to overcome that horrible coupling coefficient, you need to have a lot of mass and you need to have very high velocities. That is what we need to do to overcome gravity's intrinsic weakness. What this means is that if you're a gravity experimenter and you're hoping to do a Hertz-type experiment and measure this thing in your lab, lots of luck. You really need to go to astrophysics. It's the only thing that's going to give us the masses and the velocities which are large enough to actually produce measurable gravitational radiation. This is a blessing in some ways. If you're an astronomer, what this tells you is that because the waves are so weak, once they're generated by their source, they don't interact much. So they propagate to us, not being scattered or absorbed or disturbed by anything, and they give us an unvarnished view of whatever the dynamics that generated it are. But if they don't interact with anything, they also barely interact with our detectors. Okay? And so this means that when we try to measure it, it's a difficult process. Now, how does one go about measuring this? I think the clearest thought experiment for how to detect gravitational waves, which turns out to be very close to how we do things, in fact, today, was first formulated by Hermann Bondi in 1957. He put together the following thought experiment. So imagine you're in flat space, modulo some freely falling mirrors, and define your coordinate system so that your mirrors are fixed at some position 0 and L. And you have a gravitational wave in this thing, and you ask yourself, what is the coordinate velocity of the light as it propagates through this space-time? And so, do a little bit of math, you can easily solve for that. Now we integrate over the trajectory that the light takes. Imagine a light pulse starts at one mirror, goes out, bounces off the other one, and then comes back. This is its space-time diagram of that light position. And we find that as we look at many bounces of the light, the time of arrival between, or rather the time interval between pulses acquires a variation that is due to the gravitational wave. And so if we can measure over many, many light pulses like this, this variation, the time of arrival of our pulses, that's a way to track the gravitational wave. And this is, in fact, very close to how modern interferometers work. Okay, what key to doing this is having a good time standard so that you can actually measure the timing of these pulses to high accuracy. And so what our interferometers do is they actually use a laser as both the source of the light that bounces through this thing and as the local time standard. So it's a very stable laser. It's got a very precisely characterized, it's a clock, and that allows us to measure. The interference allows us to measure this time of arrival oscillation. So before doing this, before you sit down and go to the NSF for a couple hundred million dollars to build this thing, you might want to ask yourself, how big of an effect am I talking about? So let's go back to this estimate that I had before of the strength of my waves. Okay, so it's roughly mv squared over r with this coupling constant, where this is the amount of mass participating in my oscillation. This is the typical scale of speed associated with the oscillation. That's roughly the kinetic energy that's bound up in non-spherical motions in my source, since I'm looking at quadrupolar variations. So we can actually dream up some astrophysical sources where the amount of kinetic energy that's involved in the motions we're curious about is something like a solar mass times c squared. Put it out about 100 megaparsecs, you know, good distances where we expect there to be lots of galaxies with lots of sources. You say, great, what kind of, going back to this idea that this h is going to set the scale for the oscillation in my timing residual, how big is that going to be? And we end up with, we're looking for timing residuals that are part in 10 to the minus 21, part in 10 to the minus 22. Okay, let's hold off on writing our proposal. Let's ask ourselves, before we start to spend a lot of money and a lot of effort to build these things, are we sure that nature actually produces our sources? So to begin with, we actually caught kind of a lucky break. Independent of all this, these waves, much as electromagnetic radiation takes energy and angular momentum out of a source, gravitational waves will take energy and angular momentum out of a source. So perhaps looking out in the universe, we can find some kind of a strong gravity source with time-varying quadrupole moments in which the effects of the back reaction, of the energy being drained out due to gravitational wave emission, are apparent. We got lucky. In the 1970s, people discovered pulsars, and not too long, actually, in the late 60s, they discovered pulsars, and then in the 70s, they discovered pulsars that were in binaries with other neutron stars. Now, a neutron star is, you know, as most of us know, it's a very highly compact star, about 10 kilometers across with about a solar mass in it. And those that are pulsars are rotating at a very, very even rate. That means that they are highly precise clocks. And so we can use, basically, what nature has given us is one of the best clocks, better than a lot of atomic clocks, in a strong gravity orbit. It's a phenomenal opportunity for us to do the experiment of actually measuring the characteristics, the orbital characteristics, in rather strong field gravity situations. So this was discovered, the first one of these kinds of systems, discovered by Hulse and Taylor in the mid-70s. And on monitoring it over the course of about 30 years, it's been observed that its orbital period, so forget what this axis says, this is basically the shift in the orbital period as a function of time, is decaying. Now there's a point here which I think is not fully appreciated when people, many of you have seen this plot, but there's a point here which I think is absolutely crucial to nail home. Every one of these points is a separate measurement. You know, you can see they're spaced by many, many years. This line is the prediction for orbital decay due to the prediction for the period evolution due to orbital decay from gravitational wave emission. That line is not a fit. The way this plot is generated is you essentially take your data from one of these points, you make a measurement for several hours. From that measurement, you learn things like the mass of the members of the binary, their eccentricity, their period at that moment. That gives you then a prediction for what all future data points are. They lie completely on top of one another. No fitting done whatsoever. Okay, the error bars in this, I mean, the points that I drew, well, points that were drawn in this article I took this from, are actually much larger than the error bars. It's a phenomenal measurement. Hulse and Taylor, of course, as many people know, won the Nobel Prize for this, among other things, in 1993. And this effect has now been seen in roughly, I've lost count because there's a new radio telescope in Australia that seems to be discovering them about every year or two, but about 6 or 7 binaries of this kind have now been observed with decay like this. We are confident. We understand gravitational wave emission, that nature produces these sources. So now we need to go back to trying to do our direct measurement. And basically, our idea is to try to implement the principle of Bondi's freely falling mirrors. So when we build a system on the ground, free fall doesn't last very long on the ground. So we suspend mirrors from a pendulum, and it approximates free fall as long as you look at frequencies that are greater than the resonant period of the pendulum. I'm going to talk also about space-based detectors, where in this case, you really do make free fall. Okay, you achieve using what are called drag-free spacecraft, which are basically spacecraft that follow purely geodesic motion. You can really implement the idea that Bondi first described in 1957. So the experiments that are doing this, many people here in the room have spent a lot of their times at these sites. LIGO are these experiments, the facilities, rather, that are aiming to measure these waves based in Hanford, Washington, Livingston, Louisiana. For purposes of our talk, one of the most, there's two aspects of them that are important. One is their frequency band. Okay? They are actually sensitive to waves that come out in about the human audio. This ends up corresponding to sources that have masses in the range of stellar masses, 1 to 10 to 20 to 100 solar masses. They're operating right now. This is, in fact, a somewhat older plot of their sensitivity. For those of you who are not in the LIGO collaboration, the thing which I want to point out is that they have, in fact, this vertical scale, modulo the fact that it's a power, so you have to integrate over a bandwidth. But modulo that, this has actually achieved that 10 to the minus 22 level of sensitivity, which our back of the envelope estimate told us we had to get to. It's actually a little bit better now, but I couldn't find a good plot while I was finishing my talk. There is an ongoing program of R&D to improve this, essentially to push the floor down by about a factor of 10 and open up the bandwidth. And I believe this advanced detectors, they are going to begin, someone here can give a much more precise date than I can, but very, very soon, the interferometers are going to stop running while they begin to implement these upgrades. I'm also going to talk somewhat about LISA. In fact, much of the science results I'm going to present in here pertain to a proposed mission which is based on essentially LIGO-like concept, but with 5 million kilometer arms, which is under development as a joint NASA and ESA mission. Okay, so the idea is to put three spacecraft in a constellation which trail the Earth somewhat like this, orbiting, going around the sun once per year, just as the Earth does. The one thing which makes me slightly depressed is that my estimate for the launch date is essentially increasing at the rate of 1 year per year, but at least it's not faster than 1 year per year. For our purposes, one of its most important characteristics is that it's sensitive in a much lower frequency band, which is very different target astrophysics. Now, I'm not going to talk too much about the technology of these things, except to make one point. Those of you who are talking to physicists and astronomers who say, wow, LISA looks really, really hard to do. There's no question. Aspects of it are hard. But other aspects of it are actually surprisingly easy. A slide I stole from Carsten Dansman, he pointed out that the optical interferometry requirements that are needed to do the LISA measurement are only about an order of magnitude more sensitive than what Albert Michelson used back when he did the Michelson-Morley experiment in 1887. Okay? In order to achieve the split of fringes that went into the Michelson-Morley experiment, we needed to have a measurement sensitivity of about 600 picometers measured in the DC. Okay, this was done without looking at the oscillation of fringes. We need to be about a factor of 15 more stringent than that, but we're doing an AC measurement, which is somewhat easier. And the other thing which is worth pointing out is that this was done using, when Michelson did this experiment, he used an old-fashioned light-gathering device known as the eyeball. We have somewhat more sophisticated techniques today, and so this is actually considered to be an easy part of the experiment. Let me move on now to talk about the sources and the science that comes out of this. I want to begin by talking a little bit. I'm going to move especially a focus on LISA sources. I want to talk about where galaxies come from and how that ties into gravitational wave astronomy. If we go back to sort of the earliest glimpse of the structures in the universe, we see them in the cosmic microwave background. We see a whole array of little over and under densities relative to a mean density. Gravity grows the over densities. Gravity is attractive, so areas that are slightly denser than average become more dense. One can evolve those overdensities with a linear theory, first put forward actually by Zildjian in 1970, up till about the point at which the density contrast becomes of order 1. At that point, the linear theory breaks down, and we need to evolve the growth of structures with nonlinear numerical codes. This has been an industry in the past 10 years, and there's now extremely sophisticated results. I'm showing you here one of the largest simulations that was done. This is showing the evolution of a field of dark matter. What we see as dark matter, the distribution of dark matter evolves from the earliest cosmic times to the present, is that it grows hierarchically. Every big structure is actually composed from the merger of many, many smaller structures. In this particular video, we're just looking at the dark matter. But when one includes the effects of gas and stars and ordinary baryonic matter, you find that they merge many, many times as their host dark matter halos merge as well. As an example, someone who simulated a galaxy that is similar to our Milky Way, that predicts that since the sort of formation of the primordial galaxy that evolved into the Milky Way probably underwent several hundred mergers with smaller galaxies. That's typical. So the message to take away here is that structures like galaxies merge many, many times as they evolve from high redshifts down to our present. This is not just theory. There's observational evidence for this. So I'm going to show you just two snapshots that show this. So these are a few galaxies, this is from a sample of a particular rich cluster of galaxies at a redshift of 0.83. And what one finds when one goes in and looks at this relatively high redshift cluster, is that 1 in 5 of the galaxies in this cluster are participating in a merger event. Go down to lower redshift. Actually, there were no mergers at all. That higher redshift, things are merging like crazy. But as we move forward into the present day, they've settled down. And there's roughly a 3.4 billion year gap between a redshift of 0.83 and 0.32. So that's a significant span of the evolution of the universe. So this trend also continues out to higher redshifts. I just showed a few examples, but this is a generic result. So what observations and theory show us is that as we go out to the young universe, the structures which host us were being built out of little pieces that repeatedly merge with one another. The reason this is exciting for this talk is that we also see that going back to the earliest cosmic times, these structures host black holes. Okay, we see them all over the place whenever we look at galaxies that have clearly undergone mergers and then relaxation in the nearby universe, and we can actually measure their properties quite precisely in the nearest 20 or 30 galaxies. But we also see from quasars that these black holes were present all the way from essentially the earliest epochs that we can probe observationally. So the lesson I want to take from this is that galaxies, as these galaxies and structures merge, we form black hole binaries, which are probably the brightest gravitational wave sources we can imagine. They are a natural consequence of the way galaxies and structures were built in our universe. So I'm going to switch gears again now and talk a little bit about the waves that describe these things. What do we know about the waves from binaries, and how can we exploit that? This is an extremely outdated figure now, giving kind of a cartoon of what people expected the gravitational waveform to look like from the merger of two black holes. What I want to focus on here is that it starts out with a sort of slow adiabatic epoch in which the two bodies essentially are on quasi-static orbits that just evolve slowly due to the loss of energy and angular momentum due to gravitational wave emission. We understand this pretty well because in this regime where they're widely separated, we can use analytical techniques to model them. We know that in general, they are described by 17 parameters, which I have listed here. There's been a bias in this field that some of them are going to go away because these binaries should circularize, although that bias is rapidly disappearing. So let's go leave that 17 for now. When the bodies get close enough to one another, they will eventually come into a merger. None of our analytic techniques give us a fundamental understanding of this thing. These have to be modeled numerically, although some analytic techniques are now allowing us to sort of fit through a lot of the numerical data and understand the waves that come out of this. What's particularly exciting about the understanding we have now from this merger regime is that it's really measuring waves from this thing is going to be the ultimate confrontation of classical gravity theory with data. Okay, this is an epoch. This is a regime in which the field strengths and the dynamicness, we are nothing short of the Big Bang duplicates that kind of level of dynamic space-time physics. So as I said, there have been sort of breakthroughs in how to model this thing over the past 5 or so years, and many people in this room, in fact, are in a race to map out the parameter space associated with these things and to develop a phenomenology that can be modeled and used for our measurement techniques, and that's a lot of what the NRDA meeting is all about. For this talk, I'm going to go back to just focusing on this in-spiral epoch, because what I want to do with this thing, this is something we can model using the post-Newtonian expansion of general relativity, which gives us a nicely parameterized description of the gravitational waves in this epoch and allows us to understand how well physical parameters of the binary can be measured as it sweeps through the frequencies here. So to give some flavor of what the epochs of what goes into this post-Newtonian expansion, I'm going to describe just really in a schematic way the equations of motion we find. This post-Newtonian expansion, as the name would suggest, kind of starts with Newtonian gravity, but it puts a crank into the theory, which as we turn the crank repeatedly, gives us a description of the dynamics that comes closer and closer to the solution of general relativity. So sure enough, at zeroth order, we find this actually comes right out of the linearized stuff I described earlier. You reproduce Newtonian gravity. Now we have a crank in our theory. So we turn it, and we find the first relatively corrections to the equations of motion describing the motion of the binary. One thing which is kind of cute here is you see that the acceleration of body 1 is now proportional. It has a term that arises from the mass of body 1. That is a self-interaction. A lot of what we've been talking about at the Kapper meeting for the past couple days. Let's turn the crank again. So, some more corrections. Let's turn it again. Okay, so those of you who don't trust them, I invite you to go to Luc Blanchet's Living Review article and check the algebra here. This gives us some sense of what goes into building the motion of these things as we go beyond the leading order description. Now, although we have this very complete description of the accelerations taking up the high order in this expansion, there's physics that it doesn't completely capture. And one of the ones I think is particularly interesting is a precession effect that you can think of as being a kind of gravitomagnetism. So remember at the beginning, general relativity requires all forms of energy and energy flow to generate gravity. So when we have spinning bodies, they generate a magnetic type of gravitational interaction. And what that does is it leads to precession terms. The spins of the members of the binary precess in a way that is very reminiscent of how a magnetic dipole precesses when it's put into a magnetic field. There are two terms here. So sort of the torque on body one looks kind of like a gravitomagnetic field that arises from the orbit, crossed with body spin one, and another one that arises from the other body spin. So we have these precessions arriving from this magnetic type of interaction, which leads to new forces that modify the accelerations of the body. And it also causes there to be precessions. We still must enforce some notion of conservation of angular momentum. And so some notion of total angular momentum remains conserved, which means that as S1 and S2 here wiggle around, the orbital plane has to precess to compensate. So I have a little movie illustrating that. What we're going to see in this thing is, over here on the left, I'm sort of showing the tracks. Can't really see the blue very well, unfortunately, but you will when I start it. This shows sort of the orbital, the motion of the two black holes in their orbital plane. And this magenta stick is the vector which is normal to the orbital plane. Over here on the right, I'm showing all the angular momentum vectors in the problem. This is the spin of one of the bodies. This is the spin of the other. Here is the orbital angular momentum. And this green one is their sum. And what we see as these things begin to evolve is precession. As the two spins interact with the gravitomagnetic, basically interact with each other's spin, interact with the orbital motion. So you can see the spins are whirling around somewhat quickly. The orbital plane is precessing to compensate. And so fascinatingly, we see that their sum remains pretty much perfectly fixed. Angular momentum is being conserved, at least in this order of the equations that we've coded up here. This gives us a very clear idea of the kind of physics beyond Newton that is encoded in the motion of these things. So once we have a description of the motion of the bodies and of their spins, it's not too difficult to take that, run it through the mechanics that we've developed, to build waveforms and to try to understand what we can actually measure from these things. So if I take the two spins and I set them equal to zero, this is the gravitational waveform that I produce. It's a very simple form that sort of sweeps up in amplitude and up in frequency. To illustrate the spectral content of this thing, I've taken this and encoded it as a sound. So make sure that my audio is working. Good. OK, so if our ears could hear gravitational waves, this is what we would hear whenever black holes coalesced. As an amusing side note, remember I told you that LIGO is actually in the human audio band. It's sensitive to gravitational waves in a frequency band of about 10 to 1,000 hertz. If we had coalescing black holes whose masses were about 10 solar masses each, that is the signal that LIGO would measure. Okay? I did that. That would, no scaling was necessary in that case. If you could hook a microphone to LIGO's output and filter out a lot of noise, that is the signal that you would hear when black holes coalesced. Now, just for fun, let's take the same signal, but I'm now going to crank the spins up until they're near the Kerr maximal value. Okay? You can see some modulation on this thing here, and that's due to the precession of the orbital plane as these things coalesce, coalesce with one another. hopefully you all noticed all of the sort of round structure on top of that. That was directly how the precessional effects got encoded in the orbital phase. Now, the fact that they have such strong signatures of the underlying characters of the binary imparted onto them, that is going to be the basis of the science we plan to do with the measurements we make with these things. So here's an example of, apropos Alberto Vecchio's talk today, I should caution that these are Fisher matrix estimates for the pundits here, but they should be reliable in most cases at least. We can make estimates as to how accurately we can measure the characteristics of coalescing black holes with our instruments. And what we typically find, at least in the LISA case, is that when we see the coalescence of black holes, this is the particular example of a case where the merger happened at a redshift of 1 with plausible masses, you can measure the masses with a precision of well less than 1% in most cases. It degrades somewhat as you go to higher redshift, but it's not so bad. It's essentially just a 1 over distance fall off. Just for a little bit of calibration, we currently know the mass of one black hole to 10% accuracy. That's the one at the center of our galaxy. And most of the other ones that we have information about are known to within about a factor of 2 or 3. Okay? This is essentially entering an entirely new realm of astrophysical phenomenology. You do the same analysis and ask how well can you measure the spins, and again, it's not quite as good. It might go up to as bad as 10%, but you're still talking about making precision measurements of the spins of these bodies. Whereas at least we know some masses within a factor of 2 or 3, and in one case with 10%, we really don't know anything about the spins of black holes, except for a handful of cases where Ramesh Narayan has a really clever X-ray spectroscopy technique that can be applied to certain ones. But the vast majority of black holes, best we have are arguments that it is fast in some kind of sense, although that can't really be quantified. So what this will allow us to do, this is putting us into a regime of astrophysical, astronomical measurements where we can actually talk about doing precision black hole physics. This is particularly exciting to me because if we can measure masses and spins, mass and spin is all a black hole has got. And so by being able to measure the mass and spins of many black holes over cosmic time, you're essentially tracing their growth. You're learning something about the evolution of these structures. This becomes a window into the growth of structure in the early universe. Not only do you get things like masses and spins accurately, but we may be able to get distances very accurately as well. Let me just deconstruct this equation a little bit here. So the gravitational waveform, at least one polarization of it, has a form that has kind of an amplitude that looks as follows, times the cosine of a phase function. Now, this phase is what encoded all that information about mass and spin that I showed on the previous plots. When you make a measurement of the wave, you make a phase coherent measurement, and so you get that phase very, very accurately. The angles that appear here are essentially angles that encode where the binary is located on the sky and what its inclination is with respect to the line of sight. Once these things are pinned down, and they do become pinned down because of that spin-induced precession and because of the motion of the detector, what you are left with is a single leftover parameter that determines the amplitude of the waves. You pin down the distance. Now, I don't know how many people here do astronomy, but measuring the distance to an object is the hardest thing you can do in astronomy. Much of astronomy, at least precision astronomy, is about trying to find what are called standard candles. And the truth is, there is no such thing as a standard candle. There are standardizable candles. In this case, binary coalescence is a standardized candle in which general relativity is providing the standardization. That's a pretty damn good standard to use. And so I'm very excited about the possibility of using these things as essentially precision measurements of the distance of cosmological objects. When we go through and we ask how well can these things really be measured, you know, we actually find that we can get distances that are at low redshift. 1% is not uncommon. You can even do sort of much better than that in some cases. Going out to greater cosmological distances, you might be measuring it to 3 to 10%. Being able to say that you know the distance to some particular structure that is at a redshift of 5 to 10% accuracy can revolutionize cosmology. There's a little bit of a problem with this, though, which is that although we get the distance, we don't get the redshift. Whereas redshift is the thing that everyone in optical astronomy can pull out, we can't get that at all. And the reason is that, remember, we get things like our masses and spins by this precise measurement of the phase. That phase is a measure of the orbital dynamics. And so everything like the mass of one of the bodies or the spin of the bodies, it actually enters into the orbital kinematics as a time scale. Take your binary, put it, you know, it's evolving in the local universe, put it at some higher redshift, and every one of these timescales is going to suffer a cosmological redshift. If the timescale undergoes a cosmological redshift, so will the parameters we infer from it. And so what this means is that redshift ends up being degenerate with the binary parameters that we're trying to measure. So we can get distance, we can't get redshift, something which confuses the heck out of a lot of my astronomy friends, but it's true. Basically, the best way I think of getting around this is, what if we can associate the gravitational wave event, the merge of these two black holes, with some kind of electromagnetic counterpart? We do, in fact, pin down the position of these things on the sky, so that says, all right, you know where it is, point a lot of telescopes at it and see if there's anything going on there. A little bit of a problem there, which is that here is an example of a good localization in gravitational waves. You get sort of a spot on the sky that's tens of arc minutes, or maybe a couple arc minutes across. And, you know, if you don't do astronomy, you look at that and you go, hey, that's not bad. And then one of your astronomy friends goes, Scott, that's the full moon. That's the Hubble Deep Field. The Hubble Deep Field contains an array of galaxies that looks like this. We would essentially be trying to find the electromagnetic event associated with that merger in a patch on the sky 20 times larger than this. That ain't easy. So this is a challenge for those of you who want to think about looking for these things. I think we can do it, but it's going to be hard. What's going to make it possible will be, hopefully, something, so to speak, goes boom at the time that the merger occurs. Some kind of transient activity accompanies the merger, and Luis has a paper that is almost in press, describing an example of the kind of thing that may come out. A lot of work on this, and I think that's really important stuff. Let me switch gears a little bit and talk about my last 10 or so minutes. Talk about the kind of sources that have really been occupying our time for the past couple days of the CAPR meeting. So these are binaries that are formed by the capture of a stellar mass compact body on the black hole that resides in the cores of galaxies. We see dynamics of the kind I'm going to discuss in the core of our galaxy right now. These are, so this is an extrapolation, but it's an extrapolation based on data. Let me replay this video. Extrapolation based on data of the kinematics of stars around a 4 million solar mass object in the core of our galaxy. So we see these things on very, they're not actually relativistic. These are orbits that can be described with Newtonian gravity. But from these things, there's a lot of reason to believe that there'll be even more objects down closer to here. Sometimes objects like this are going to be put onto an orbit that's so relativistic it becomes a strong gravitational wave source, an extreme mass ratio in spiral. So we would have a binary, much as I've been describing, in which the space-time is really dominated by the larger member. What's exciting about this sort of comes in two flavors. One is that we can hope to bring perturbative techniques to bear on it. You can describe the space-time of the system, schematically at least, in an expansion that is sort of a perturbation theory that's controlled by the mass ratio of the system. Hopefully isn't as bad as doing the full 3 plus 1 dimensional Einstein field equations in complete generality. The other thing that's exciting about it is that because of the large mass ratio of the system, it gives us, in principle at least, a probe of the strong field region of black holes. So I'm showing you here an example of the kind of some of the tracks of the measurables that we get here. If I look at a small body that is orbiting a rotating black hole, it's actually characterized by three completely independent frequencies. As I move to very, very large radius, of course, everything limits to Kepler's law. But as I move into the strong field, roughly speaking, strong gravity acts almost like the way magnetic fields do in the Zeeman effect. And they split that Kepler line into distinct frequencies associated with the radial motion around a black hole, the polar motion as it goes up and down about the symmetry plane, and the axial motion as it goes around the spin axis. By measuring these frequencies like this in the waveforms we hope to observe, this tells us a lot about the character of strong field spacetime. So a perhaps clearer illustration of the dynamics associated with those frequencies I'm showing you here is a small body on a geodetic orbit of a Kerr black hole. And you can see this thing as it zooms in a small radius, it kind of whirls around before it goes back out to large radius here. The physics of that is really nothing more than the physics of perihelion precession. That's the same basic physics that causes Mercury's orbit to pick up a couple extra arc seconds per century as it goes in its elliptical orbit around the sun. And these orbits are a little bit more relativistic than Mercury, and so it's a stronger effect, but this is basically just perihelion precession on steroids. So to model this kind of a system, what we're looking at is taking a quiescent black hole and perturbing it with a small body. We require that the Einstein equations hold in the full spacetime of the perturbed black hole. And what we find is that that causes the small body's trajectory to essentially modify the geodesic equation that we teach all of our students in first year general relativity. It becomes the geodesic equation plus a self force that arises from the interaction of that small body with its own spacetime deformation. And many of us, this was first, in fact, the impetus for the first CAPR meeting was the then recent publication of papers by Mino Sasaki Tanaka and Quinn and Wald showing how one can construct this self force and beginning to think about how to exploit it. This was given an unforgettable name by Eric Poisson at CAPR 2 or 3 or something like that. So it's from now on the Misa-Takwa formalism. So what does this mean in terms of our observables? Self-interaction has two important effects. One is a conservative interaction, which we can think of as taking those frequencies I described to you earlier and shifting them. Okay, so that causes these things to shift a little bit from their geodesic values. That's going to show up in our models because of these various precessions that you saw in the video I showed you before. They're going to be modified. Okay, there's going to be what I would think of as an anomalous precession, at least relative to the geodesic formulas that you can look up elsewhere. That's going to have an observable imprint that we have to build into our models if we want to measure these things. And there's also a dissipative interaction, which is what causes these frequencies to evolve. This can be thought of as equivalent to the loss of energy and angular momentum, the same basic physics that led to that chirp I showed you before in the comparable mass case. So if you want to solve these things, roughly speaking, at least to first order, the idea is we're going to take Einstein's equations, require these things to hold, and they will turn into some kind of a system which hopefully, looks like now we have to go beyond the linear order, but at least when I made this slide, I was just thinking of linear cases. You have some kind of a linear operator acting on a perturbation of space-time, equaling our source. And the hope is that because this is perturbative, it can be done precisely enough that we can actually build a phase-coherent model of the InSpiral over hundreds of thousands of orbits. It's a hell of a challenge, which is why we've been working on this for 12 years, and we're beginning to get some really exciting results that I think can be start to built into these kinds of things, but it's been a lot of work. Here's an illustration of what will come out of this thing. So those of you who were at some of the morning sessions, this is an older version of the video that Steve Drasko played for you. What I'm going to show you here is the InSpiral of a small body around a Kerr black hole, including, at least at leading order, the dissipation due to gravitational radiation acting on this thing, and illustrating what the gravitational waveform looks like as it spirals along. So we can see right away the incommensurateness of these different frequencies. Although it's kind of interesting how every now and then they come close to being an integer ratio of one another. You see the pattern freeze in the kind of Lissajous figure when that happens. That is something which we discovered in the past couple of days. We have important observational consequences. But what we would need to do is track this waveform, illustrating it on the poles here, as this thing moves through all of the different worlds. The noise is becoming a little less eccentric as time goes on. For some reason, your last frame crashes my laptop, so I froze it there. So this is our challenge, is to be able to build some kind of not just models for the waves, but also techniques to measure signals that have this kind of characteristic in the presence of noise, in the presence of other binaries. This is the challenge that has led to why we've been here for the past couple days and really meeting like this for the past 12 years. The application, what is really driving a lot of this is sort of what keeps me interested in this field, is what can we do with these things once we're actually making these measurements? And what is beautiful about this is that all these orbits, these things that are in that little sound file in the movie we just showed you, is that the small body is whirling around in the strong field of what we presume to be a Kerr black hole. Okay, that is the assumption we build into all of these things. I'd like to test that. is there a way that by making precision measurements of these waves, we can actually test the hypothesis that these are, in fact, Kerr black holes? Do more than just sort of measure the parameters in the astrophysics, but actually do some fundamental strong field physics with these objects. If you want some motivation for that, I'm going to appeal to one of my scientific heroes. So in a lecture in 1975, Chandra said that the realization that an exact solution of Einstein's equation of general relativity provides the absolutely exact representation of black holes that populate the universe. Chandra described this as the most shattering experience of his scientific life. This is a guy who did a lot of great stuff in science. And so the idea that this was the most shattering thing, that sort of carries a lot of weight. It also tells me, though, that he's a theorist. And there's another motto I like to bear in mind. You should test your theories, okay? And so what we would really like to do is find a way of testing the faith Chandra had that these are, in fact, objects that are exact solutions of the equation of general relativity. The idea which we have formulated to try to do this has a conceptual similarity to the science of geodesy. The basic idea of geodesy is take the gravitational potential of the Earth and expand it in a multipolar expansion here. If you require, so these B coefficients basically map out the shape of the potential. And of course, Newton's gravity satisfies Poisson's equation. So you take the the plus operator on this thing. These B coefficients also tell you something about the distribution of mass in the Earth. Make precise measurements of the orbit of a small body, a satellite, going around the Earth. You map its accelerations. You map its potential. You map the distribution of mass in the Earth. Here's what you get. So these is the distribution in this plot here. Areas that are red show places where the Earth is somewhat more massive than the mean. Areas that are blue are somewhat less massive than the mean. This is what is done with, this was actually done with just sort of about a year or two of data of these satellites tracking around the Earth and making very precise measurements of their trajectory as they go around the orbits. I saw a talk by these guys about a year or two ago, and they have a fascinating result, which is that in very late December 2005, the gravitational field changed at the, they could measure a change in the gravitational field at the 25 sigma level in the oceans a little bit west of Indonesia. That was the Boxing Day earthquake. They could actually see at literally about 25 sigma the change in the distribution of mass due to that earthquake. Amazing stuff. They can also do things like watch the polar caps melt as a function of time. The CE in this mission actually stands for climate experiment. Well, we'd like to do something like that for black holes. The idea here is that one can describe an axisymmetric space-time in a similar way that we describe the potential of the Earth with a family of multiple moments. So since both both energy and energy flows gravitate in general relativity, we describe the space-time using a family of mass moments and mass current moments, analogous to electric moments and magnetic moments. But black holes satisfy the no-hair theorem. And so that tells us that although, in principle, we have an arbitrary family of moments like this, they must be completely fixed by the black hole's mass and its spin parameter. And this result here, which was this characterization of them, was developed by Gerosch and Hansen. This tells me that if I have a Kerr black hole, this is what these moments must be. I love this because this gives us a consistency test. If you measure, you measure the first moment, that tells you the mass. You measure the second moment, that tells you the spin. You measure the third moment, if it's a Kerr black hole, you already know what it is. So if you can measure more than two of these moments, you have enough information to falsify the black hole hypothesis. How do we actually go about doing this? Okay, I'm going to wrap up in just a moment here. Point which I'd like to take away, and this is sort of something to think about maybe for Kappa 20, we have a powerful formalism to test gravity in the weak field, the parameterized post-Newtonian expansion. We need to do something similar for the strong field if we're going to do these kinds of tests of gravity with these objects that I've been trying to describe here. One idea, one that my groups have been working on, is to say, well, let's imagine that I have a black hole with a little bit of schmutz on it. Okay, I'm going to take its multiples and sort of push them away from the Kerr values. We call this a bumpy black hole. And then ask, how is the bumpiness encoded in observables like orbital frequencies? You can then formulate this as a null experiment. If black hole candidates are, in fact, general relativity's black holes, you measure the bumpiness of your black hole candidates, and it should be zero. This means then that I'm essentially suggesting that we take all the framework that we've been developing over the past 12 years and then say, oh, and by the way, let's now do it for non-Kerr spacetime. So those of you who are busy writing self-force codes, sorry. All right, well, anyhow, that is my hour. I'm going to end here, which is sort of my final thought is what I think is sort of exciting in these two workshops is we're seeing theory and experiment coming together basically the way we never had before. This almost feels like we're real physicists, guys. You know, we're actually putting together black hole theory and experiment. And I think we're about to start doing strong gravity phenomenology. And so when we have Capra NRDA meetings and we have discoveries, signals that we can actually work with, I think we're going to need more than a week. So thank you.
Questions?
There's one in the back.
Yes, speaking of signal, so what are the current event rate estimates for advanced LIGO once it's in place?
So I am not as up on the literature as Ilya Mandel here. So I'm going to defer that one to you because you've written one of the papers on that.
So there are, of course, very significant uncertainties because we have few observations of binary neutron stars in our galaxy to extrapolate from, and no observations of neutron star black hole binaries or black hole binaries, so those have to be based on modeling. But that said, it's plausible to have tens of events per year detectable in the advanced detector era, but those numbers are uncertain at the level of 1 to 2 orders of magnitude in each direction, so numbers could be as low as half an event per year, and could be as high as several hundred, perhaps 1,000 events a year.
I think it's safe to say, though, that if it runs for 4 or 5 years at advanced sensitivity and doesn't see anything, that would be a huge surprise.
Just a comment. I wish you said that the experimental search for gravity waves is now a LIGO-Virgo joint search.
I should have. You're correct.
In an earlier talk, there was a slide showing a high event rate for LISA for events back to redshifts of greater than 10.
Right.
I was wondering if you confused me a bit. I was wondering if you could comment on that from viewpoint. I presume this is done by some event rate modeling.
That's essentially right.
What assumptions about early galaxy formation is that?
So what goes into that, essentially what is tied into those estimates of the rates, especially going back to high redshift, is you take a merger tree, such as one like the that is related to the kind of visualization that is given here, which tells you something about the rate at which dark matter halos are emerging. You have to have some assumptions about what the distribution of black holes are at the core of those things. And so, at every one of these dark matter halos, there's going to be a lot of baryons, there's going to be a lot of stars and galaxies. At the earliest cosmic times, it's an open question. Do they have black holes at their cores or not? Okay, what we see when we look in the universe near us, so at the relatively nearby universe, is every galaxy that has sort of a nucleus, something with a spheroidal nucleus, appears to have a black hole in its core. We can't tell going back to very, very high redshifts simply because it's hard to do that. So you build in some assumptions. And so that is one of the reasons why when Alberto Vecchio showed those curves of event rates, there were several layers. They corresponded to different plausible assumptions about how one populates the early dark matter halos with the seeds of the black holes in the galaxies we see today. And so, it ranges from assuming that they may form from kind of a genes over density that collapses at Z of 20 or something like that, and so you have seeds of 10,000 solar masses that populate only, say, if you take that the early thing, maybe only in this sort of 5 or 6 sigma over densities. There's another set of models that postulate that they may have formed from population 3 stars at a redshift of 15 or something like that and left behind seeds that are about 100 solar masses. And these all lead to kind of a spectrum of possibilities. What's a little depressing is every one of those possibilities ends up giving us a picture in the modern world that is consistent with observations. Okay? Every one of those possibilities will reproduce the local distribution of black holes and their mass distribution. But they give very different predictions for what the merger tree is, the number of mergers that are seen as a function of time. So that's why I probably should have said, along with neglecting my Virgo colleagues, I also should have pointed out that even if you're unable to get, even in the absence of the kind of precise measures of mass and spin that I discussed, getting information about the rate of these things is already tying in an enormous amount of wisdom that tells us about the formation of early structures.
What is the latest news on how much the effect of weak lensing can be circumvented or mitigated in determining the distances to these?
That's right. Blocks? So let me just put up a slide here to give a little context to this. So when I discussed the possibility of measuring, measuring distance with these things, I made some claims about how accurately this can be done. Now, when we do the calculations that give us these distances, you sort of imagine that the gravitational waves are generated from the source and they propagate towards us completely unhindered, and voila, these are the accuracies that we get. The real universe is not Friedman-Robertson-Walker, though. Okay, it's FRW with bumps. Okay, we live in a lumpy universe. And that lumpiness causes, we observe it in the optical and X-ray all the time as gravitational lensing. These gravitational waves will likewise be gravitationally lensed. Okay, this is a place where general relativity giveth on the one hand and taketh away on the other. So all of these little events are going to be slightly, the amplitudes are going to be slightly enhanced or slightly decreased depending upon the particular path by which it goes from its source to us. And so if I do kind of a Monte Carlo simulation in which I ask what is, on average, the amount of magnification or demagnification applied to the amplitude of my gravitational waves and how that impacts the distance measurement, that actually kind of sets, we're actually probably never going to achieve this unless we actually make a measurement at relatively nearby redshift. Once you get beyond a redshift of about 1, gravitational lensing blurs this out such that you can probably never do better than 2, 3, or 4%. Now, people have been thinking very hard about whether you can sort of apply corrective lenses. Suppose we know something about the distribution of matter between us and the event that generated the gravitational waves. Can I back out and account for the fact that if I knew the matter precisely, I could, in some sense, model out what the magnification or demagnification was and try to recover this intrinsic precision? All the work that I have seen on this suggests that you can improve it a little bit by very, very careful modeling of the intervening matter distribution. But the problem is that a lot of the scales on which the lensing noise enters is much smaller than what are resolved by the surveys that give us the matter distribution. So what this means, the example Daniel Holtz gave at a talk in Sydney a couple years ago was of a particular supernova in which people use something like 10 or 15 Hubble orbits to make a very precise weak lensing map and infer what the intervening matter distribution was, because this kind of lensing noise also affects supernovae that are used for standard candles. And so there was one they really wanted to nail down as much as possible. And so, literally 15 or so Hubble orbits, followed by many hundreds or thousands of postdoc hours of effort reducing the data and trying to improve it, and they improved the precision by about 10%. Okay, so they went from sort of an 8% level of noise to a little better than 7%.
If I could make just one more comment in response to John's question. I think that as Scott pointed out, there is definitely, you know, depending on the assumptions that go into the modeling, there are a variety of different merger tree scenarios that one can come up with, and they give different kinds of sources merging. But one thing that does seem to be sort of in common between them is that fairly generically you do have some kinds of mergers going on. And so I think this actually makes a good argument for having, you know, looking even further into the future, for having detectors covering, gravitational wave detectors covering a variety of different portions of the gravitational wave spectrum. Because if, for example, rather than having 10 to the 5 solar mass black holes merging at redshift 10, you instead have 100 solar mass black holes merging at redshift 10, then LISA may not be very sensitive to those sources, but something like the Einstein telescope or the Big Bang Observer or something of that sort could be much more sensitive to them.
Okay, so I think we're going to move to the coffee break. We have to be back at 3:30.